Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and the topic of our discussion today is a New Deal Part 2. So Dr. Goodspin has given you Part 1 and a nice introduction to the New Deal and all the great, wonderful stuff that's going on in that particular time period of American history. So it's my job to kind of back clean up here and wrap up the New Deal into the 1940s. And of course, Dr. Goodspin will take it from there into the 1950s. This is a transformational period in American history. Franklin Roosevelt is perhaps the most important figure in American history. You know, he's often listed as one of the greatest presidents in American history, and I think unjustifiably so. But if you look at presidential rankings, you're always going to have Abraham Lincoln up there and George Washington, and then Franklin Roosevelt. Usually Roosevelt's number three, perhaps number two, sometimes even, I mean, I've seen him number one, but all that's based on the fact that many of these leftist historians view Franklin Roosevelt as their guy. And that's a travesty, because Franklin Roosevelt is without a doubt the one figure in American history, if you look at a watershed era, really is the 1940s and where we are today. You had people, precursors to Franklin Roosevelt, who were just as problematic, people like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, even Abraham Lincoln. But Franklin Roosevelt is going to put all of that stuff together and give us perhaps the most destructive administration in American history. When you look at war powers, the powers of the central government, the powers of the executive branch, the powers of the judicial branch, because Franklin Roosevelt's impact on the judicial branch is going to be felt long after he's gone. By the time Roosevelt has been elected for his fourth term, the Supreme Court is almost entirely a Franklin Roosevelt creation. So Franklin Roosevelt is this figure in American history that needs to be addressed by our side. And Robert Higgs has done a great job with that. Burton Folsom has as well. And, of course, some of the older histories, people like John Flynn and Charles Tansel, did a wonderful job in the 1940s and 50s going after Franklin Roosevelt. But typically, the histories written about Franklin Roosevelt are very sympathetic. And it wasn't uncommon in the South in particular, other parts of the country where Roosevelt was wildly popular, to have two pictures in your house, and that would be Jesus and Franklin Roosevelt. So even before Barack Obama became the savior of the American people, and with hope and change, you had Franklin Roosevelt on the walls of some Democratic households as a character that would be along the line of Jesus. I mean, this is how crazy this is. Roosevelt is the only man, of course, in American history elected four times. So that's also one of the big issues that we'll talk about in this particular presentation. Just a real tyrant in so many ways. And in my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Real American Heroes, I actually list Franklin Roosevelt as the fascist fraud, because his programs are very similar to what we had in Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany when you look at the New Deal. And so constitutionally, it comes down to the question as to whether this stuff could actually happen or not. Dr. Goodspin has already addressed many of these issues, and I'm going to, again, kind of wrap up the end of the New Deal in the 1940s. Talk about, you know, World War II and some of the things going on there and some of the constitutional issues. And then some of the stuff that's going on after the Roosevelt dies, but his court is still having an impact on the way we think about America and American law. So, again, Roosevelt, you can't deal with the 20th century without looking at Roosevelt. He is that important. You know, we can talk about Lyndon Johnson and the Johnson administration in terms of running over the Constitution, which they did with the Great Society. And you will look at some of the other issues with some of the modern presidents in the last presentation when we talk about Richard Nixon and you know, the imperial presidency, and of course then into the modern era with Bush and Obama and Clinton. And so, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff to talk about there, but, you know, it's Roosevelt is this transformational, you know, watershed figure in American history. You have to deal with Roosevelt. And we need more work done on Roosevelt, because if we can tear him down, then we can tear down the entire statist establishment. It's very hard to do, though. A lot of Roosevelt supporters out there, a lot of people consider Roosevelt to be the prototype for a great president. And if you look at our responses to economic downturn, our responses to war, I mean, World War II and the Great Depression are foremost in the American mind, unfortunately, because typically the history written about these is the exact opposite of what it should be written. You know, the people were writing great history with again, Tansel and Flynn, and then some of the others, you know, Folsom and Higgs, but nobody pays attention to their work. Everybody pays attention to the idiots out there writing these pro-Roosevelt books and saying that World War II was a complete surprise attack and all this other kind of stuff, and ignoring some of the horrible things that took place. We're even justifying it, even on the conservative side, you know, justifying, for example, Japanese internment camps and some of these other things. So let's get into Roosevelt. Again, the New Deal is a transformational time in the United States, both in terms of perception and policy, which I just mentioned. When the economic downturn hit in 2008, the response was, we need to do the exact opposite of what Herbert Hoover did. Well, I wish we were doing the exact opposite of what Herbert Hoover did, because Herbert Hoover was the architect of the New Deal. And it was Roosevelt who came into office, you know, riding in on his white horse, who was supposed to save America. And so that's the kind of thing that we're getting out of this. I mean, the way that even the presidency is viewed in little things like when the president first comes into office and the press will ask the president, what are you going to do in your first 100 days? Well, my gosh, I wish the president would say, who cares what I'm going to do in my first 100 days? But Roosevelt, of course, set the agenda there. He said, well, in my first 100 days, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. I'm going to have this new deal. I'm going to have a bank holiday. I'm going to get all this legislation rammed through the Congress. And that's essentially what happened. You know, this idea when Nancy Pelosi said, well, we have to pass the bill before we know what's in the bill. I mean, because nobody had read the thing. Well, nobody was reading the New Deal legislation either, really. I mean, they were just going in and rubber stamping whatever Roosevelt wanted. He was taking over dictatorial powers. And he even had people he appointed called dictators. These are what we now call czars. And every president since Roosevelt has used them, some more than others. But he had dictators who were out there trying to take over certain parts of the economy. You know, so when Barack Obama recently said he's going to have a cabinet department on business, you know, this is just how silly this stuff is. Of course, he's got a dictator for everything else out there, or a czar. Nobody understands where this stuff comes from, but it all comes from Roosevelt. I mean, Roosevelt is the most disastrous person in American history in terms of the way we have government. We can all bash Lincoln, and Lincoln is important because he's the beginning of it. But you might even go back to Andrew Jackson there. I mean, you know, Lincoln is very much a Jacksonian in the way he'd use executive power. And Lincoln's terrible. And then, of course, we get Teddy Roosevelt, and he's terrible. And Woodrow Wilson, he's terrible. But Franklin Roosevelt's worse than all of them. Because, of course, he did serve three terms and a little bit of a fourth. You're going to get executive power in the active Supreme Court. So the executive in this particular case is so important. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. If it wasn't for Roosevelt, we may not have the view of the executive branch that we have today. If it wasn't for the fact that Roosevelt declared a bank holiday and shut down banks unilaterally, and during World War II, all the terrible stuff that happened in terms of the centralization of the economy during that particular time, which went even further than the New Deal. I mean, World War II allowed the New Deal to even go further. World War II allowed the New Deal to take 100% effect. And what I mean by that is that, you know, Roosevelt always wanted to centralize power, always wanted to have the United States government take over the economy to try to, quote unquote, save it. And World War II allowed that, which, as it did, you know, the architect for World War II and our intervention in the economy there was Woodrow Wilson in World War I. But Roosevelt took it further. And, of course, the active Supreme Court. From this point forward, you know, in the 1930s, the Supreme Court was still interested in blocking the power of Roosevelt, at least in some ways. But by the time the 1940s roll around and Roosevelt's had a chance to put his stamp on the Supreme Court, it's a rubber stamp. And this is what we have most of the time now. The Supreme Court doesn't do much of anything to block federal power. It only enhances it. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court was going to do in this particular period of time, particularly when you talk about the issue of incorporation. It was the Supreme Court during the Roosevelt years, and of course Roosevelt's Supreme Court, with the exception of one judge, that's going to give us the incorporation doctrine. And that's the most important development of the 20th century in terms of the relationship between the states and the federal government. If we don't have this Roosevelt Court, this disastrous Roosevelt Court, we don't have this idea of incorporation. And I'll get into that in a little more detail. And then, of course, we've got world government. It's during Roosevelt's time that we talk about the United Nations and having this world government. Of course, doesn't happen while Roosevelt's alive, but we get the United Nations. And the United Nations is disastrous for American sovereignty. So we'll talk about that at the end of the presentation. So a lot of nice, fun, meaty stuff here that we need to get into. And again, transformational stuff, you know, stuff that will affect us for the next, into the present, you know, next 60 years as this stuff is being put into effect. So let's start with the nature of the executive. Now this goes back to the Philadelphia Convention. And there was a tremendous debate in Philadelphia over what the executive would be like. Everyone knew that George Washington was going to be the first. Everyone knew that George Washington was a great man. Now, he really is the most important man in American history, without a doubt. Anyone that says otherwise doesn't understand the full impact of Washington. Everyone loved him. It didn't matter who you were, you loved George Washington. Now, we can complain about, the Whiskey Rebellion and some of the things that Washington did and siding with Hamilton too much and these kind of things as president, but Washington fully understood that everyone was watching him in the executive branch, and he did try to limit the power of the executive as much as he could because he didn't want the president to be seen as a king. But there was a great fear as to what would happen after Washington's in office, and of course he's only going to serve 2 terms. Washington, in fact, tried to get out of serving more than 1 term. He wanted to retire in 1793. He was persuaded to stand for election again. He did. He was elected for a 2nd term. Of course, it would have happened regardless. But he steps down after 2 terms, which gives us the Washington precedent. The first person to break that precedent, of course, is Franklin Roosevelt. Now, the debate in Philadelphia centered on things like, how much power is this executive going to have? Is he going to have the power of the purse and the sword, which was considered very dangerous? Is he going to serve for life? Is he going to be, how long is the term? Is it going to be 4 years, 6 years, 8 years? I mean, how long? And if this guy's obnoxious, how do we get rid of him? I think that one thing we should think about with the executive branch, and perhaps this is one of the reforms that people should be pushing, we have the 22nd Amendment, which limits the president to 2 terms, and we had that because of Franklin Roosevelt. But maybe we should be talking about even changing that to a 1 6-year term instead of the ability to stand for election again. Generally, Americans thought that if the president was doing a good job, that he should be able to stand for election as many times as possible in the founding period. They were hoping that Washington would do that. After Washington, we get John Adams, and John Adams is not George Washington, and everybody that follows, and we've had some disastrous presidents since. And this was even pointed out. People were afraid. Benjamin Franklin said, we all trust George Washington. What comes next? Charles Pinckney of South Carolina said the same thing in the letter. What comes next? What comes next in this particular situation? We're afraid of this. So the president has a lot of power. We have to be careful that we don't allow that. We have to have the Congress in concert with this in trying to limit that power. And they meant, If the president was going to continue in office, he had to be in good behavior. So if you had this 1 6-year term, the president, of course, can't stand for re-election again, so he's going to do whatever he wants in that time. We've all seen here now after the 2012 election all the crazy things that are going on that were being held up for the election because Obama full well knew that if he allowed this stuff to hit the press, if the administration allowed this stuff to hit the press, then Obama was not going to win that election. And so he holds up, all the stuff that was going into effect with the Obamacare, all the taxes that are going to hit, all the intrigue going on with the CIA and the FBI right now, all of that stuff here in November of 2012 was held up for weeks so that Obama wouldn't get blasted for it and lose the election. Now, if he only had a 6-year term, all this stuff would come out anyways. There would be no reason to hold it up because he can't stand for election again, and therefore impeachment would actually mean something. Everyone thought that impeachment, if the president was abusing his constitutional powers, he could be removed from office. And so impeachment would actually have some teeth. You can get a president out perhaps in their 2nd term, but, the 1st term is just, it's going to be nearly impossible because the president will generally hold up the bad stuff until they're reelected again. And, that's the terrible thing about it. And, of course, good behavior meant that you're not abusing the powers of the Constitution. That's what the founders meant by that. Now, Franklin Roosevelt, as I said, determined that he was even better than George Washington. He's going to run for a 3rd and then a 4th term in 1940 and 44. Now, the only chance to stop him that the opposition actually had was 1936, and they ran a stupid, just a terrible candidate, a moderate Republican who was just a little more, it was just a little, Roosevelt light, Wilkie. That was his name, and Wendell Willkie, and just a terrible choice, just like 1948 when they picked Dewey to run against Truman, which was a terrible choice, just like picking Mitt Romney in 2012 was a terrible choice. You can see the writing on the wall, they were going to lose. Wendell Willkie is a horrible candidate. They had a chance to get him. Now, Roosevelt wasn't the first guy to consider actually running for a 3rd term. U.S. Grant considered it in 1880 and it didn't materialize. And, of course, Teddy Roosevelt was president from 1901 to 1909, He was only elected once in the 1904 election, but he basically served two full terms, and he decided he was going to try to have a third term, essentially, in 1912. So there were people before who thought, well, you know, we can certainly run again. No problem with that. And of course, now the 22nd Amendment, which was put into effect because and ratified because of Franklin Roosevelt, limits the presidential terms to two. So thankfully we have that, but you know, King Roosevelt wasn't stopped in his three terms and a little bit of a fourth. Now, as far as the New Deal court, by the time Roosevelt dies in 1945, 8 of the 9 justices on the court were his appointments. And so, regardless of court packing, you know, Roosevelt in the 1930s wanted to pack the Supreme Court with his guys. He didn't need to, because by the time he dies in office, the court is basically his. So this is a rubber stamp. Whatever Roosevelt wants, Roosevelt gets. And they're declaring constitutional some of the most egregious laws, I think, in American history. Roosevelt is very effective during an end-around Congress by using executive orders. He's very effective in abridging the powers of the states. And one of the most famous things that the court is going to declare constitutional is Executive Order 9066, which set up Japanese internment camps. I mean, you think about that. Here we are fighting a war in Europe during World War II, supposedly to help liberate Jewish people that were under the Holocaust. And as American soldiers are moving through Europe and they're finding these terrible concentration camps, we've got them here in the United States. And the Supreme Court declares it constitutional. This is almost shocking. So we have things like the NDAA today, which is a suspension of habeas corpus, and I'll talk about that with the next bullet on this PowerPoint slide. But we can have concentration camps because the Supreme Court said they were constitutional during the last years of the World War II and the New Deal. Said they're constitutional, perfectly constitutional. I mean, that is probably one of the most egregious rulings that the Supreme Court has ever had. That you can have concentration camps. It's hard to get over. You know, see, we're saying that the Nazis can't do it in Germany. I mean, my gosh, it's a violation of human rights. But right here in the United States, we're taking Japanese Americans, many of which had been here for generations. Of course, some were, you know, new arrivals. But a lot of these people have been here for generations. We're saying, you know, you can't keep your business. You can't keep your property. You're going to have to move to an internment camp in the desert and live there and become, you know, Americanized. And they would take them to re-education classes and things like that. I mean, these were considered constitutional. So what's to stop the government from doing it now? And don't think they don't have plans. If there's some type of problem, they can round people up and put them in concentration camps. The Supreme Court said it's constitutional. So obviously it is, right? I mean, if this Supreme Court says it, it's obviously constitutional. This is how disastrous this court is for civil liberties. And then we have the extension of war powers beyond hostilities. The Supreme Court says it's fine. Once hostilities are over, who cares? You can still continue the war powers that you need, whether they're executive or legislative. Again, preposterous. So this is why the NDAA is so dangerous. Essentially, since 1941, the United States has been on a war powers footing. We haven't stopped. Because after World War II is over, just a few years later, we have the Korean War, and then, you know, a few years after that, we start getting involved in Vietnam, and then ultimately Vietnam conflict, and just a little bit after that, you know, we're involved in other places around the world, and finally the Middle East. So we've been on a wartime footing. Our expenditures for defense spending have never gone down. I remember as an undergraduate, all the political science professors, many of whom were Marxists, others were just, you know, leftists. This is the one thing they had correct, that, you know, the United States spends a lot of money on defense, which we all know is offense, and they've been on a wartime footing since Roosevelt was in office. So civil liberties can definitely be abused, as we've seen with the NDAA and the ability to suspend habeas corpus at will. If that's the case, you know, you're only supposed to be able to suspend habeas corpus, the Congress can, if the situation determines that it's necessary, if you're basically... in a state of insurrection, or you're being invaded, rebellion. I want to know what's going on that says that's necessary right now. And again, the Supreme Court said this is fine. The United States is not under attack right now. There's no state of rebellion, but yet habeas corpus has been suspended. Obama said he's not going to use it, but how do we know that? So people can be arrested and thrown in prison now and held indefinitely. You know, we can be put in concentration camps, all because the Supreme Court said this stuff is constitutional. That's how scary this is. And people, most Americans are walking around oblivious to this. It's extremely dangerous. Also, you have the idea of selective incorporation and incorporation during the New Deal Court, at the end of that. We'll talk about incorporation in the next slide, but selective incorporation is the idea that you don't have to incorporate everything. Only certain amendments can be incorporated or should be incorporated, while the others can just be, you know, not incorporated into the state constitutions. And this is the way it generally worked in certain areas for a very long period of time. The last case would be the Second Amendment. Selective incorporation left out the Second Amendment from the states because it was an unpopular amendment among the court and the leftist-leaning individuals on the court. So the gun rights community was very hot about that. But this is the problem with incorporation, because you would get that. If one amendment's incorporated, then they all have to be incorporated, or vice, you know, not the other way. And, of course, I would argue against incorporation because I believe that the Constitution should be followed as ratified and, of course, amended with the Bill of Rights. And that brings us to that issue of incorporation. The case that will incorporate the Bill of Rights into the state constitution is known as Everson v. Ewing Township, and it's a case in 1947. It's the first time the Supreme Court uses the incorporation doctrine to incorporate the First Amendment into state constitutions. Now, this whole issue of incorporation was broached in the founding period. James Madison actually wanted to incorporate the Bill of Rights into the states in 1791 or 1790, and he proposed an amendment that would have done it. It was rejected unanimously because people said this is unnecessary. The states already have their own constitutions. What do we need another layer of constitutions for? The states already had their Bill of Rights. What do we need another layer of Bill of Rights for? The Bill of Rights are to affect the federal government only. And so from that point forward, generally up until about 1947, that's the way it worked. Right? I mean, the states had their own constitutions, the states had their own Bill of Rights, and so the states could do generally what they wanted. The federal government could not abridge the freedom of press, speech, religion. The federal government could not deny your right to keep and bear arms, but the state governments could. So now with Everson versus Ewing Township, that changes. Everything changes. So this is incorporation, and it's taken time, but generally, since 1947 to present, now just about every of the first eight amendments has been incorporated into the state constitutions. So this is the disastrous outcome of this particular decision. And it flies in the face of what the founding generation wanted. If you look at the preamble to the original Bill of Rights, these are restricting clauses on the federal government only, not on the state governments, but on the federal government. So and let me just bring up this Second Amendment issue again. I know a lot of people on that side that really push for, you know, the incorporation of the Second Amendment. We, of course, just had recently in 2010 the McDonald ruling, where it said that and the Heller decision, where it said that the Second Amendment essentially was incorporated into the states and the District of Columbia. And people are championing that. Well, here we go. We finally got it. We finally got the incorporation. But at the same time, these same gun rights activists are not for incorporation on other things. Oftentimes, you know, they're not for incorporation, say, of the First Amendment, but yet they want the Second Amendment incorporated. It's either got to be all the way, one way, or all the other way. And it's a slippery slope. You start talking about incorporation, and then you get into issues, well, I mean, a lot of these gun rights activists are for capital punishment. Well, what happens if the Supreme Court says that capital punishment is unconstitutional now because of the Eighth Amendment? You've incorporated it. And so now the states have no block. So you have to be careful with this. Your first line of defense is always your state constitution and your state Bill of Rights. And that's where we should be looking. If you want to have a protection for your individual right to keep and bear arms, then it should be at the state level. I mean, according to the Second Amendment, the federal government cannot say they can prevent people from being armed in any ways. I mean, we should be able to have a tank if we want one. We should be able to have any machine gun we want, or even a nuclear weapon if that's the case. You know, because the Second Amendment is only it only prohibits the federal government from doing that. Now, of course, thankfully, the state constitutions would block the idea of people having nuclear weapons, because, I mean, that would be extremely dangerous. And the states could say you can't have a tank or you can't own machine guns and all these other kind of things. But, and hopefully they would do some of these things. You know, we don't want people walking around with nuclear weapons. But, you know, that was a state issue, not the federal government. This is where this incorporation doctrine can get pretty abused. So it's abusing the 14th Amendment, which that's the basis of this. They're using the 14th Amendment and the Privileges and Immunities Clause and, things like the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. So they're going after it that way. And unfortunately, they're misinterpreting what those particular amendments mean. And then, of course, you have the Adamson v. California case in 1947, which was the rejection of incorporation according to the Fifth Amendment. So here in the exact same year, the exact same court says we're going to incorporate the First, but we're not going to incorporate the Fifth. So that's problematic. They're inconsistent. So you have to incorporate all or not all. And that's unfortunately, where we've come in this whole debate. So the gun rights advocates are saying, well, we've incorporated everything but the Second, so it's time to incorporate the Second. I would say that we should not incorporate any of them and, let that be the law of the land. It's going to be hard to get back to that position, but that's really, if we're taking a constitution as ratified and originally amended position, that's the position we should take. Now, the United Nations, fun issue, a terrible issue in some ways, but an interesting issue. The constitutional problem with the United Nations. Now, first of all, can United Nations law or resolutions, is what they are, supersede American law? Well, when you get to the situation with our military, oftentimes it can. There are people that firmly believe that once the United Nations passes a resolution, the United States should follow it. And a lot of these people are, for example, global warming advocates, man-made global warming proponents, who would say that if the United Nations says that carbon dioxide is a poisonous gas, that, perhaps people should walk around with carbon dioxide collectors on their mouths and make sure we don't breathe out any carbon dioxide, because that's a poisonous gas. And they would be perfectly fine with that. People walking around with masks. Or maybe we should, make sure that cows don't have any bovine flatulence because that's causing problems. We should just slaughter all our cattle. These are the kind of things that these advocates would say. Well, the United Nations said so. This world government said so. So we should be on board. We should cap our greenhouse emissions and all these things. We should get all this stuff because this, the United Nations said this world government. Well, I hope not, because that's abridging our sovereignty and our ability to do, to act as in our self-determination. This is crazy stuff. And the other thing, of course, is American soldiers. If American soldiers are going to go into harm's way, they should be under American general officers. And they're not all the time. There's the very famous case of Michael New, who refused to serve under the United Nations. And, of course, he's had all kinds of legal problems because of this. But he was doing the exact thing he should be doing. If you are a soldier in the United States military, the only people you are directly responsible to answer to are general officers or your officers in the United States military. I mean, that's it. That's the chain of command. You don't answer to, some general from South Africa or some general from France. I mean, these people are not your commanding officers. But this is what happens. Americans have gone into combat and you've had United Nations officers commanding them, and I think that's dangerous because that violates our sovereignty. There's no doubt about that this could cause all kinds of problems in the future with the United States being the world police power that it is. And beyond that, we have this issue of perpetual war for perpetual peace. Since the United Nations was formed after World War II, we haven't had World War III, but at the same time, we've had more wars, and the United States has been dragged into wars because of the United Nations. I mean, a nice example is the Korean War. A nice example of how the president now looks at this particular issue is the situation in Libya. He didn't go to Congress and ask if we can have military action in Libya. He went to the United Nations and asked if we can have military action in Libya. I mean, this is what people are thinking now. We should just skip the Congress and we go to this world government and we ask if we should have police action here around the world. This is very, very dangerous for the American people. And nobody really realizes that. We should be getting rid, defunding the United Nations and kicking it off our soil because this causes problems for American sovereignty. My grandfather was a firm proponent of the United Nations because he said it would solve the problem of having a destructive World War III. And again, it has done that, I guess. I mean, it's been perhaps one of the reasons why we haven't had one. But American soldiers have bled in all kinds of countries around the world because of our disastrous foreign policy, and not just that, because the United Nations has forced us into some of these actions. Also, I mentioned here the influence of UN resolutions on American foreign policy, and it's mentioned the Korean War. Another big issue, of course, is citing international law in American courts. I mean, what are we doing? This has happened now. The federal court system has cited international law. Well, when did that happen? I thought that the reason we had the federal court system was to act as a referee in case of the states, or dispute between the people of the state and another state, or your two states. I mean, that was the idea, not to cite. And so we're citing the Constitution in this, but not international law. But this is what it's come to. You know, and you had Ruth Bader Ginsburg, saying that perhaps we should look at other constitutions than our own for examples in what we should be doing here. This is preposterous. It's scary almost that people are actually going beyond American law now to find answers to American problems and American questions. Thomas Jefferson said the Declaration of Independence was an expression of the American mind, not the expression of some international mind, but the American mind. The Constitution is an expression of the American mind. It was not formed by some foreign nation, and we shouldn't look at it that way. So going to international law is extremely dangerous. And then, of course, I have up here, this world government and the issue of American sovereignty. And I put Gene Roddenberry for fun. A lot of people, of course, like Star Trek. I think Star Trek is a lot of fun to watch. But Gene Roddenberry is a way to popularize this United Nations and this one world government idea. If you look at the Star Trek, I mean, the Earth is actually under the control of a one world socialist utopian government. And then you have the United Federations of Planets, which is kind of this world government idea. So Gene Roddenberry, through Star Trek, was making this whole idea of a United Nations or a world government popular. And, of course, it has to be Marxist and utopian. It can't be anything but. And if you look at Star Trek itself, I mean, all the issues that you have there, when it comes to religion and diversity and all these kind of things, I mean, that's what Gene Roddenberry was all about, to make these things palatable to the American public. And you run into alien races and you have the Borg, and they're going to assimilate and all this other kind of stuff. But I mean, in reality, that's what's happening on Earth. Everyone's assimilating. this is what Roddenberry wants. He wants people to believe that world government should be there and should be effective, and we should break down all these national barriers that we have out there. So just for fun, I threw Gene Roddenberry in there for this discussion. In summary, you're looking at the centralization of power, an active Supreme Court of the United States, and the loss of federalism. And so we're shredding the Constitution in this particular period of time. With incorporation, we're losing federalism. The states' rights are dead. Centralization of power under Roosevelt with his czars and or what he called dictators, and the King Roosevelt running four times, doing all the things the New Deal did, which, of course, Dr. Gutzman got into in a good discussion. I mean, this is just a completely running roughshod over the Constitution. It's the final death of the founder's executive. If it wasn't dead before Franklin Roosevelt, if Woodrow Wilson didn't kill it, or Teddy Roosevelt didn't kill it, or Abraham Lincoln didn't kill it, Franklin Roosevelt killed it. We don't have the founder's executive anymore. We have something completely opposite of that, and the antithesis of what the founders would want. If they could look ahead and see what, we have Barack Obama, who has more power than George III ever had, they never would have ratified this Constitution. And, of course, the Supreme Court of the United States now is an extension of the executive and legislative branches, a rubber stamp, basically. The Supreme Court just, rubber stamps everything on through, for the most part. They rarely declare things unconstitutional. That was, if you listen to some of the proponents of the Constitution, that's what it was there for. If the Congress was abusing its authority or the President, the Supreme Court could step in and declare stuff unconstitutional, but they don't. And finally, I put on here Murray Rothbard and the Dixiecrats. So again, this is a little fun caveat to all this. Murray Rothbard, of course, Jewish northerner, supported the Dixiecrats in 1948. And one of the reasons why is because of this particular issue of the loss of federalism and states' rights. I mean, Murray Rothbard, the great libertarian, in so many ways an old American conservative, is saying, this 1948 election between Truman and Dewey is no real election at all. We need to support somebody else. So he actually supported Strom Thurmond in 1948 for states' rights and limited and federalism, limited central government, because he could see very clearly that if you vote for Dewey or you vote for Truman, you're voting for centralization, because they were essentially, just a millimeter's difference between the two candidates, and was no real choice. So you go with the third party in this particular case. You go with the people that are advocating federalism, as the Dixiecrats were in Strom Thurmond, and you hope to change the system. It didn't work out. Of course, the Dixiecrats weren't elected. But here you have Murray Rothbard setting an example for all other people who are looking at, for 2012, I voted third party. If you're going to vote, you should vote for third party. Or, as I mentioned in a Lou Rockwell piece a long time ago, a couple of years ago, you should vote for 3 years ago, you should vote for the candidate that least resembles your views if you don't really have a choice. You can't vote third party if the party's not on the ballot. You should either not vote or, you know, go out there and vote for, you know, if you think that Obama's worse than than Romney, vote for Obama, because at least you're going to get to the point where things get bad and you can make a change there. So, anyways, this is a wonderful time period to talk about in American history, because it really exposes the, you know, the emperor has no clothes at this point. It exposes the empire for all it is in terms of domestic and foreign policy. And several historians were highly critical, say, for example, of Roosevelt's handling of the war, and took a lot of hits for that. You know, Charles Tansel's foremost among them. So we need to read that stuff. We need a better evaluation of FDR and the New Deal and his foreign policy. If we had that, you know, this would be a wonderful a book for anyone looking as a graduate student now or looking for a topic. Go out there and attack Roosevelt. It needs to be done. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed the presentation. I'll see you for the next presentation, which will be the last of the course. And I'll see you next time.